This week, silver added to gains, ending near $17 an ounce, while the Dow Jones Industrials picked up about 600 points, ending at yet another all-time record high in its more than 100-year history. Hello, everyone. Chris Waldseck back with you. We've got even more need-to-know topicality to help you make better informed investment decisions. This week, Amazon.com opened up the first employee-free retail outlet. No clerks, no cashiers, virtually no managers. Simply walk in and walk out with bags of items. Is this the future of retail unfolding in real time? Well, it might seem implausible, but just a few years ago, the only way to watch movies was in a theater or with a VHS tape machine. Or what about ATMs? People thought that'll never catch on. Now you hardly ever see a clerk. If this is the future of retail, is it also the future of unemployment? Millions of retail and management and even transportation jobs might evaporate, according to experts, over the next 5 to 10 years. What we thought could take decades is now playing out in real time. As tens of millions of remaining jobs evaporate, the powers that be in a lead are talking about UBI, Universal Basic Income, where homes might receive thousands of dollars a month just to help maintain the status quo. Think of it as the new EBT card. And that might send prices even higher. Joining me with his take on the situation, Bill Murphy. He agrees that the end game will be runaway prices. He thinks the precious metals are nearing a bottom. And Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors brings decades of experience to the show. We discuss the national money supply and the opportunity to return to a constitutionally sound gold and silver-backed dollar. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. We'd like to hear your questions and comments. You can reach us at 641-715-3900. The extension after that is 514049. The number again, 641-715-3900, extension 514049. Please jot it down by your phone or plug it right in. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly sunny weather appeared over the precious metals this week as the strong U.S. dollar put some pressure on the yellow metal, but silver actually closed higher. Gold was off only about $16, 1.4% at $11.61 an ounce. Silver finished at about $17, up 13 cents for the week. The precious metals XAU off just 2 points, 2.7%, ending at 80. Black gold finished near the break-even point as well at $51.50, following last week's explosive 12-plus percent move on news that OPEC would cut crude oil production. But the top story impacting the metals this week was clearly the U.S. dollar, which blasted to the highest point in years on increased expectations that Italy might be the next nation to lead the EU following a referendum vote on Sunday. Plus, the Federal Reserve will raise rates a quarter point to 75 basis points next week. It's virtually a sure bet. That's at the FOMC meeting slated for December 13th and 14th. Policymakers will also reveal their so-called dot plot, which sketches out their predictions and forecasts of interest rates and growth measures for the coming year. The current Fed funds futures also suggest another rate hike by June of next year to as high as 100 basis points. Precious metals bottom line. Although the December FOMC rate hike is already factored in, the market news from Europe sent global investment flows pouring into U.S. equities, which boosted demand for the U.S. dollar. Once institutions realign portfolios after the rate hike in the next few weeks, as well as perhaps the upcoming inauguration, traders will likely recognize just how oversold gold and silver investments are. The XAU does appear somewhat vulnerable right here to a knee-jerk washout. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange as global funds poured into the U.S. as investors continued to buy up shares in anticipation of a new wave of economic growth after the upcoming inauguration. The Dow Jones Industrials picked up nearly 600 points, 3%, finishing just shy of 20,000 at 19,750. The S&P 500 picked up 67 points, 3%, finishing at 2260 for the week, while the NASDAQ Composite added 188, 3.6%, finishing at 55444. In related news, the European Central Bank noted on Thursday that it would extend its QE operations until at least this December and possibly beyond that to as late as March of next year. That lit a fire under the U.S. dollar as Investors turned away from the euro in favor of the greenback. Officials did hold rates steady, however. Despite the strong greenback, though, one investment firm noted this week that precious metals appear to be bottoming as investors buy the rate hike rumor. They might just sell the fact in the coming week or so. Bottom line on equities. The VIX volatility index and its derivative, the VVIX, collapsed. And these are signs of greed, along with our favorite seven indicator sentiment index, which confirmed extreme greed reading. According to our valuation models as well, stocks are simply so overvalued, it's difficult to quantify just how large the reversion to the mean will be. Nevertheless, the euphoric crowd and the end of year dynamics could buoy stocks. While the momentum is strong, classic signs of a blow-off peak are certainly showing up from every direction. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here.
Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of Institutional Advisors.
Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Chris, and also with your listeners. We have an absolutely gorgeous day in Vancouver. Sunshine, snow on the ground. Still freezing. Vancouver doesn't often get snow. This is the banana belt of Canada, you know.
Yes, it is. And that I presume that would be due to the warm weather that, of course, circulates from the southern hemisphere.
On the coast, so you get the moderating effect of the ocean.
Canada is regularly, the people are voted the nicest people in the world.
Yeah, no, a lot of that is self-promoted out of Ontario, who is solidly liberal. And they just think they're absolutely wonderful. The sun is streaming into my office. I got the curtains closed and it's warm.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you know, nothing better for you, especially in the wintertime, keeps the circadian rhythm right. It shakes off the seasonal affective disorder blues. It massively increases your vitamin D production.
I'll tell you a secret about how old-time Vancouverites judge the weather. You look at the mountains, and if you can see the mountains, you know it's going to rain. If you can't see the mountains, you know it is raining.
After over 15 years of NAFTA sending our jobs, we've hemorrhaged something to the tune of, I want to get this right, close to 6 million industrial jobs. It's several thousand plants. Industrial plants have shut down. Here we have this one individual who is now threatening CEOs, if you take your plants and your manufacturing overseas, you can do so, but how about a 30 to 35% tax on you if you do it?
That's tailored to be attractive to the Democrat labor side. But he's going to accomplish the same thing with lower taxes and lower regulations anyway.
I really believe here that this is more far-reaching statement. The shot heard around the economic globe. We're not going to let you gut our nation anymore, multinationals. If you want to do business here, you're going to have to look out for the domestic population first. That is absolutely, I think, the most profound thing that any politician has done since at least the mid-80s.
I appreciate that because in being a financial historian, it also makes you a political historian. And my thesis has been that there has been three great experiments in authoritarian government in the senior economy over the last 2,000 years. And you determine this by just reading the history, but also in looking at the price history of consumer prices. And the 3rd century in Rome had prices went up by about 40 times as the government turned authoritarian, price and wage controls backed up by the sword. And then eventually the public threw it off. Then the next time there was 100 years of similar price inflation was in the 1500s, and it ran into the early 1600s, and it was the same thing, only that and that one, the ambitious bureaucracy, there was only one organization for the bureaucracy to corrupt, and that was the Catholic Church. And it became, it became bloodthirsty as well. But the folks took a look at it and said, this is not right. A family man in business, raising kids and doing business was good. The church became predatory, and it was thrown off in the early 1600s. Then the next period following the early 1600s is, they've called it, you know, small-L liberalism, like the real thing. sovereignty of the individual and limited government. So then somehow, beginning around 1900, the world went off into another century of authoritarian government and all of the excesses. And this is now our case is that this is culminating. So within all of this, even going back to ancient Egypt, you've had popular uprisings, and it was always about a restlessness amongst the local people and government being living well while the locals were not living well. And then they would have there's an explanation then for dynastic changes in ancient Egypt. The public would show off the governing classes. And then you move forward to in Europe, in the medieval period, there would be peasant riots. And then in the late 1500s, there was one that a historian described as it was a typical peasant riot turned into an iconoclastic rebellion against and the Spanish government in the Spanish Netherlands. So here we are, restless public, looking at the incredible excesses of unlimited government, even within Canada and the United States, beginning to do something about it. So this a piece published on July 4th, Independence Day, called The American Spring, and then looked back at the Prague Spring of 1968, which was a strong attempt, but then the authoritarian government quelled it. Then more recently you had the Arab Spring, and the authoritarian quelled that one. So we asked the question, would the American Spring be successful? And I purposely used rural term. And this step by Trump, it should be put in perspective. The movement is a popular uprising. It happened to choose Trump as the leader, and he will be bound by this popular uprising. And I think most of what he will do will be within the approval of this popular uprising. Now that he's very colorful, he may be offensive to some people's sense of good taste, but he won't be offensive to good order, and other than extremely upset liberals out there and Democrats who are, just have had the greatest shock in the history of expanding authoritarian government within the United States. So here it's with the election, published a piece called Draining the Swamp. And this will happen. It is the same thing as in the early 1600s when individuals, the Reformation is better to be followed in England rather than in Europe because Europe had turned nasty with the 30 Years' War, whereas in England, the transition did suffer the Civil War in 1642, but essentially it was bloodless. So it took a number of attempts to end an extremely authoritarian government. And one of them involved in the early 1600s, a long boom had come to an end, and also a war had come to an end, so there was unemployment and hardship. So the government in England felt compelled to do something, so they came out with an absolutely preposterous idea. There's no need to explain what it is, but the merchants in London looked at it and condemned it. They said, this is just absolute nonsense. And then you had the crash that began in 1618, and it was proved to be nonsense, and it was very expensive. The crown suffered a huge loss. And at the time, these practical merchants looked at the plan and called it tyrannical duncery. Like in today's terms, it would be tyrannical stupidity, where somebody with authority has got a whim to do something and is going to do it. Is that the really big example of tyrannical duncery is the notion that a committee of bureaucrats can manage the temperature or the climate of the planet. I mean, this one is so preposterous, you can't believe it. Ancient past, even priesthoods, merely set themselves up to intervene with the gods, and they never, ever really would claim to be God.
We're not getting into a political minefield here, but what is, I think, hopefully can resonate with the typical American listener, because we have such a global audience here, but with the American listener is, it is quintessentially American for the pendulum to swing back. It has been overwhelmingly swung to the one side for at least 24 consecutive years, and I would argue that's the globalist and elitist side. And now the shot heard around the world, interestingly, occurred first with Brexit, I think, and you could argue maybe with Grexit.
Yeah, that was June.
Yeah, Grexit, Grexit, then Brexit. And let's not forget the next topic du jour that I'd love for us to discuss, and that's the Itsit, if I'm saying it correctly. The Italy exit.
You rang the bell with Brexit. Looking at an authoritarian government in Brussels that was not just authoritarian, it was remote. So then let's go back to the United States in 1775, 1776, when the issue was not just an authoritarian government, but a remote government because it was in England. And at that time, unfortunately, the British crown was and ran it too hard. This is similar. The American Revolution was what I call a benefit, as nasty as it was with warfare, but it was a beneficial revolution because it was run by merchants, smallholders, farmers, tenants, mechanics, the whole thing. Whereas with the French Revolution, later, 1797, we were in different cultural circumstances, and the popular dissatisfaction was taken over by what I call neurotic intellectuals, and it went into a reign of terror. So then the other big revolution was the Russian Revolution, 1917. It was taken over by neurotic intellectuals and became a reign of terror. So the best example of a revolution is in England in 1688 called the Glorious Revolution, and it was peaceable. And it was run by merchants, let's put this back up now, Protestant merchants out of London and Protestants through the rest of the country. King James was Catholic, and in order to impose his authority, he even talked about bringing over troops from France. Now, that was a big no-no. So anyways, it was a very successful revolution and won by the guys. And that then completed Great Britain's reform from absolutist monarchy to a parliamentarian system. So the intellectuals have been in control. They created a distorted Federal Reserve in order to do it. And then as if managing the economy wasn't enough to do, they then had on the challenge of managing the temperature of the planet. I mean, this stuff is so absurd that a few years from now, people are going to look back on it and say, well, how did it ever happen? But it happened because constitutional limits were bypassed. And also, that would be in more or less political activity or the excesses of government, but also is funded by an extremely reckless central bank. And again, a non-convertible currency is unconstitutional. So the Americans have had a very paranoid written constitution that was designed to prevent exactly what's been going on for the last 20 years. And in England, you don't have a written constitution, but you have a long tradition of legislation and statute and law that normally would have prevented such an experiment. But as I said, it brewed up in 1900. It's run ever since, and there's only been two other examples in the last 2,000 years. And what is really exciting, Chris, is that this thing is ending. And the other thing is you got the weather, the climate cooperating. You now have The El Nino drove temperatures up sharply into 2015 and through most of 2016. On the air temperature, satellite determined over the land, the last few months have recorded the sharpest decline in that temperature reading since you've had satellite temperatures, what, 28 years ago. I mean, this is very sharp. So the way to look at it is that the El Nino is a weather event. Now, then the other major climate event through the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you had a solar maximum that was the most busy period for the sun in thousands of years. And then with that, you had, I still think, and you look at any number of charts on it, that if you take temperature history in 25-year segments, that the 25 years focused on, this, say, the 1930s, so you go 1930s into the 1940s, was the warmest period, and it still is by a number of measures. You got to understand that the climate promotion industry is desperate to have their theory about carbon dioxide proved. So they have actually been lowering temperatures from 20, 25 years ago, maintain an uptrend, and they threw in a lot of garbage stuff from ocean temperatures. But if you take the satellite record, as this El Nino disappears and a La Nino comes in, it'll be back to the flatlining temperatures of the previous 18 or 19 years. And this, then, is most distressful to the establishment, which has been promoting hysteria. So here we have a political reform going on, which is natural because of the excesses of the governing classes. At the same time, the solar system has arranged to bring in an end to a few hundred years of rising temperatures. Well, more than a few hundred, say the Little Ice Age reached its coldest in the late 1600s, and it's been warming on that basis ever since. And now the solar physicists who forecast in the 1990s, they forecast the turn to a solar minimum, they've been right. This solar minimum is likely to continue for a number of years, and it's already back to the lows of early 1900s, and some solar physicists feel that this could even go so far as to back to something similar to the Maunder minimum, whereby in the late 1600s, the solar activity, well, there were no sunspots at all. So for an old retired geophysicist like me, this climate side is very exciting.
I just finished this fascinating book by Emanuel Dermet, a physicist as well as a self-made quant, and he's actually considered one of the fathers of modern financial quantitative analysis. In the book, he discusses how when he was in school, and it was mostly Ivy League schools, he, of course, born and raised in South Africa and emigrated to the United States, how they had an interesting box. People by the thousands would send into the Ivy League schools all these theories and theorems and concepts, and he concentrated mostly on this crackpot box. And it dawned on him, that's what I'm more interested in. And the key takeaway point, you know, there's something like 250,000 theorems that are proved each year around the world. Of course, it would be impossible for anyone to wrap their minds, even read that many papers and comprehend all of these new theorems, mathematical, that are postulated. The people who got the reins, who grabbed control of the Western society for the last 20, 30 years, the Keynesians, hardcore Keynesians, their work deserves to be in that box. It's brilliant, it's well thought out, but it doesn't work in reality.
What I've used on that one is that Keynesian economics of the central bank adjusting interest rates to help the business cycle, and then the state coming in with expenditures or stopping expenditures, has been a great theory. But you can, it's I've explained it as the equivalent. The comparison would be from Euclidean geometry, which describes the real world, straight lines, parallel lines, angles, that sort of stuff. Then you have non-Euclidean geometry, where you start with some other assumption.
I would argue that non-Euclidean geometry is the real geometry. The Platonic geometry and the Aristotelian are actually fallacious, and here's why. There's this very interesting man who I just finished the second reading of his biography, and we've all heard of the Riemann hypothesis and, of course, the zeta function. Math was combined with physics. It was one and the same. So he created this non-Euclidean geometry, which we now know today as Riemannian manifolds. This little-known patent clerk in Switzerland picked up on the idea of Riemannian geometry and incorporated it into his general relativity, and that is where he got his curved space-time concept. Latest shot heard around the world by Italian voters on Sunday evening. They voted no. Now we had the Grexit, we had the Brexit, and then we had the Trumpsit, I guess, and now we have the Italian banks are counting on their EU confederates to help keep the system afloat. What does this mean for Italy, the euro, the eurozone, and the United States?
The yields in Europe, the 10-year notes from Germany to England to Italy to Portugal, had been rising in anticipation of this. I guess the latest focus was the Italian vote. And then they backed off in the last few days. But interest rates in Europe are now rising trend, the 10-year note. And in the U.S., of course, the yields reversed in early July to rising. That's the long end. And then also you had LIBOR start to a really strong advance as well. So that has to do, well, when we made the call on the long bond in early July, we never bothered putting a reason on why long rates would go up. It was just that the technicals were so strong for a reversal. Now, looking back at it, what has happened is there was a wave of positiveness came through, and so you had the U.S. third quarter GDP number, although it's as phony as it was, better. And that's to the end of September, so it was before Trump. So things have been positive here, and interest rates going up is based with that. But overall, Chris, this is another great reformation following another great experiment in authoritarian government. Now, with the Reformation in the 1600s, because religion was such a dominant part of life then, it's been described as the Protestant Reformation. And I like to explain to people, take out the capital from capital P, Protestant, just say protest. Or take out the capital N from a nonconformist. Just so. This was the ordinary citizen looking at the governing classes living very well and intruding on the life of ordinary people. The church in the end of the 1600s found more reasons you could think of in order to confiscate money. Many different rules and regulations, and then the other way that they were able to get even at small merchants was to declare priest day, saints days, and church holidays. They were up to something like 125 in a year, and workers would take the day off. So here again, the imposition of the state, that then was a combination of state and church. Now here, what you have with what the movement in the United States faced with this election was that you had a combination of big government, IRS, Justice Department, FBI, combined with the media, which is supposed to be independent and critical, as in Fourth Estate, all combined with the Democrat Party. So this was a powerful movement that there's no doubt in my mind that it was aiming to set up a one-party system. And you've had the shock of all shocks. The electorate became galvanized enough.
Here we have an actual leader who's being vilified by the media, rightly or wrongly, to put an end to the tyranny of the dollar. And, of course, we're not anti-dollar here. They're talking about capital controls in Turkey. And then we move over a little bit further to India.
I look at it as ending action for their experience with authoritarian government. This is so you have to have the government doing something that is so bizarre that the public says, hey, you're out of here. And this is what happened in the U.S. The whole apparatus of the movement, Democrats and media and Department of Justice and everything else just became so bizarre. And the more bizarre they became, the more the ordinary person got pissed off and said, you're out of here. I'm going to vote. And so the point, I think the term I've been using, ending action, really is appropriate. It's like anything in the markets where it's in short supply and the bulls get more and more aggressive as it goes up. You got the shorts trying a little short and then forced to cover, so you have short covering buying going on as it peaks. So this movement in politics is like a huge short squeeze, where in this case, the shorts are the old movement that has gone to ending action, and here's the result. So I'd expect, and I have a friend who is a mining analyst, he's very good, Jayant, we should make the introductions. He's originally from East India. His piece last week had a very good comment on it, but I don't know that he's calling for ending action. He's just, at the moment, describing it as absolutely outrageous. But the history side suggests that it is ending action, and you will see a reform movement begin to become effective in India at some time. I mean, not being there, you can't. I'm not in a position to say when. But I can tell you the focal point of the U.S. win on the election is the defining moment, the defining event. And I've also written that it is irrevocable. There is no taking it back. This one is just so profound. So it's sort of like when you were with Eastern Europeans in the late 80s, where they looked at the governing classes, the nomenclature, the apparatchiks, and said, you guys are living well, your promises are bogus, and we're not living so well. And they took on a murderous police state in Eastern Germany, and Poland, and Russia, and they shut it down. And they ran the risk of, and here's where the interesting part is, that the authoritarians in, let's say, East Germany or Poland talked about sending in the tanks like they did in Czechoslovakia in 1968. But there seems to be, Chris, a moment in time where the imposition of authority is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of hammering with the fist. And then the other half of the equation are those who are subjected to authoritarian, and they have a complacency to go along with it. And then there's an instant in time where those on top lose the will to impose authority, and those below look and realize, hey, this is the change. That was the case. Now, do you know the date that they brought down the Berlin Wall was November the 9th, 1989. Now, the date that the results of the election were realized in the United States was November the 9th. Sort of interesting date.
It leads to massive global hyperinflation that will ultimately collapse the entire system.
What you have here is, let's look at the control of information. In the last Reformation in England, you were in a period where the state and church had virtual control over the media. They could only ones that could afford to pay the scribes to write the books. Sure, printing was coming along, but folks didn't have much money to buy the books. But by the time you got to the early 1600s, there was prosperity, the middle class were growing, and the cost of publishing was diminishing. So, but the state was very used to controlling. They also had, in the case of England, through the Anglican Church, they also had the pulpits. What they called news books were being published with the stories, books, accounts, information that the middle classes wanted. So that's when Archbishop Laud was head of the infamous Star Chamber. And if you didn't shape up according to the dictates of the Star Chamber, if you were a prosperous businessman with stature, but they weren't going so far as to state murder, that was for exceptional cases. The uprising classes in England had their news books published in Amsterdam, which was free, and shipped over and then distributed. So the point is that even with immense control over the media, the uprising bypassed it, and this is where, in this case with the U.S. election, Trump and his tweets and the whole media, so you were able to get around the mainstream media and defeat them, and they will continue to be defeated. So then, now that's the political side.
The IRS has just ruled that they can go through your blockchain and check for transactions in order to prove whether or not you have been paying taxes. Again, I'm a huge proponent of cryptocurrencies. I've actually created my own Humble, a silver bit, which is based on silver dimes. They're going to regulate every single thing they can until we're down to a fully digital economy. And then anyone who dares to use gold and silver coins and things that will be vilified, I believe, Prime Minister Modi has actually said publicly, we will tax every single transaction.
Yeah, Chris, that was the political change. Now, this is where the public take over their government from the experts, prove that you can have a self-governing country. And these threats on money side and everything else, those are projecting the past into the future. The next step will be, as the public is taking control of their government, they will also define their own money, and it will be a plain, simple currency with a gold standard, gold convertibility. Because, as I said, on the previous experiments in authoritarian government, they were funded through confiscatory taxation, which the public threw off, and they were also funded by massive depreciation of the currency, which the public ended. So the two things go together, the intrusion and the currency depreciation, and I would expect the similar thing to happen, that the public are taking control of their government, and they will also define what money is. And these threats, as we're seeing in India now, which could be implied to North America, that is ending action. This, we're in the most exciting times for finance and for politics since the last Reformation began in the early 1600s. So I'm highly confident that, one, the ability of the public to take over government will happen. And also the other thing is the public will define money, and that will happen. The worst thing that can happen for a bureaucrat is where they fear the public. We're going out of the system whereby the public lived in fear of the government. When you're talking about Modi's doing and what they may do in the United States to money, that's fear, and this is what will be ending.
I think you're really paraphrasing that of one of the founders. That is, when the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is freedom. We certainly see some signs of it. And I think just at the nascent portion of this potential populist movement, it could be quashed from the globalist movement. Suddenly, economic conditions have deteriorated to a point to where they recognize their machinations can no longer prop up the entire doomed edifice. Would it not be the perfect time to drop that on the populist movement and allow them to think they voted their heroes into power, whereas in reality, they're planning to drop the entire thing on them?
The success has already happened in an uprising with the fall of the Berlin Wall. At the time, when the uprising was underway, before it got so successful as to take down the wall, if you were reading National Review, they were trying to write that this was some sort of a skullduggery thing done by the Soviet government. At the time, I was saying, look, it's just like what happened in ancient Egypt. The folks got fed up. Now, in ancient Egypt, the governing classes were protected in the palace by the palace guards with their spears. And then as the researcher on it back then in the 1970s, Barbara Gray, pointed out that at one point the palace guards were of the people, not of the governing classes, and they laid down their spears. Then you had anarchy, which meant... I was expecting that in the late 80s in Eastern Europe. The palace guards were not palace guards, they were border guards, and they had AK-47s. And then in one day, they laid down their weapons and allowed the people to go cross-border shopping. And at that point, Honecker, the dictator in East Germany, had to change the law that insisted that he then execute Germans who wanted to go from one part of Germany to another. So the your atomic or your nuclear bomb is going off, but it's going off against the authoritarians. It was fascinating to me that where Eastern Europe suffered enjoyed a great reform in 89, that through Obama, you then had a rush in authoritarianism such that in the senior economy, it came right out to the end of the 100-plus years of authoritarian experiment. And you could say that the fall of the Berlin Wall was the first leg of reform in Eastern Europe. And then under Putin, you've had a counter-reformation move, whereas the main move, authoritarianism, as experienced in the United States, has run right up to recent and is enjoying the changes. So I see this as being very similar to the end of the last experiment in authoritarian government into the early 1600s. The same struggles, and I hope, and I fully expect that as it continues this reform, it will not in Canada, the United States, or England go to bloodshed. It is going to be extremely nasty because those who have had the power are going to be like 3-year-olds in a tantrum, but with weapons. But they won't use the weapons. The power of the people on this kind of a movement, as I said, in two previous examples, particularly the last one, last one meaning the early 1600s, they took on formidable powers. The state could confiscate, just accusing you of heresy, they could confiscate your property. Then if you didn't shape up, you had an interview with the Department of Inquisition. Then if you didn't shape up on that one, they burned you at the stake. Uh-uh. We won't see any of that this time around because it's a very powerful, as Victor Hugo said, there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come, and this is where we are now. So, yes, you are concerned, and I'm concerned about what's going on in India, but it'd be best to look at it as ending action and whereby in the United States, the authoritarian movement may want to do what India is doing. So, fascinating.
It is, and I like your idea that eventually the people will establish a gold-backed currency. Of course, the implications of this idea are maybe more profound than we have the time to delve into today. In order to back trillions of dollars, the yellow metal would require either suddenly a gold-making machine, a manufacturing machine, or a significant repricing higher of the yellow metal.
It depends on the faith and credit of the new administration when it will go to a gold standard. And all it has to do is meet obligations. Like you're going to go in today and take out a dollar's worth of gold, you can get it. But U.S. going back to a gold standard can be done very efficiently. The market will know at what price. A simple letter of instruction from the president. He is getting advice from a high-up guy on the restoration of a gold standard. Yeah, well, we've been advising institutions for a long time on interest rates, credit spreads, yield curve, commodity prices, business cycle stuff. And we can be reached at institutionaladvisors.com, or if you just Google my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, it all comes up anyway. So, and we would welcome people to look at our website. We've got the whole track record in there.
Well, we welcome Bob Hoy to return to the show with more topicality in 2017.
Very good. Okay, Chris, next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Bill Murphy runs the Gold Antitrust Action Committee GATA with Chris Powell, exposing the gold market manipulation story. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
I'd like your thoughts on this Deutsche Bank story. Of course, we've heard about the silver market rigging and other rigging. It started about 8 months ago, and now not only are they implicated in the manipulation of the gold and silver markets rigging, but offering up their colleagues. Apparently, there are several large banks that were involved in the rigging scheme. That's really no surprise, I'm sure, to diehard GATA readers. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the subject.
It's only taken 19 years. It's, this is where GATA started out. We said was going on 19 years ago. It's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the real thing, Chris, that it's involved not only these bullion banks, but, you know, the Fed, the Treasury, you know, the BIS and other people. But if I may, this is exactly what Andrew McGuire was going to testify in front of the CFTC. He sent all this information regarding J.P. Morgan in the same area what they were doing. Back in the beginning of 2010, he was going to testify. And when they wouldn't let him testify, he got a hold of Adrian Douglas and myself, because I was testifying in front of the CFTC. And in the question and answer period, we were able to get this in which he said how the J.P. Morgan traders and other traders were communicating and what they were doing in the silver market. And this was, you know, how many years ago? More than half a decade. It's all been fact. It's all been there. It's all being done. You can see it every day in the market action, or every day, but so often. And it's about time this kind of stuff gets exposed, because It's just killing the gold and silver markets, what these people do.
Exactly. And, you know, I find it interesting that people forget, you know, just the term the gold and silver price fix. Behind the scenes, behind closed doors, at certain specific times during the day and the week, they have been involved in rigging or fixing, if you will, the price for, if not decades, maybe even longer. There was an interesting story that broke that claims that due to self-driving trucking and cars and Uber cars and so many others, that in less than 6 years, 5 to 6 years, millions of delivery jobs will be lost due to this automation. And we thought it was going to be 10, 15, 20 years down the road. There is a huge push to accelerate it. And I know it sounds a bit fantastic to some of our more senior listeners, but if it does, you may have read that Amazon.com just opened up their first fully automated store without a single person checking people out or greeting them or anything. You swipe your Amazon card, you walk in, you grab your items, you don't even check out. It scans you on the way out the door and charges your card automatically. It checks to see if you have the funds available before you even buy anything or leave the store. If you put an item back, it pulls that off of your card automatically. So we're looking at one of the biggest changes, I think, a sea change in unemployment in the next 5, 6, maybe 7 years.
Well, you know, I've seen that, Chris, and it's a brave new world, and it's pretty scary for a lot of little people that are out there, you know, working hard and trying to earn a living. And I'm not sure about the ramifications, but if President-elect Trump is going to try to go all out to help a lot of these people are being displaced, he's got a big problem with that one.
Now, you just brought up another great topic. I just read this morning that he has brought potentially 50,000, created 50,000 new jobs through negotiating with the CEO of SoftBank. And they have agreed to invest, according to this article, roughly, I want to say $20 billion in the United States, which theoretically, as I said, creates 50,000 jobs. And I'm sure you've been reading about how he plans to tax companies that try to move jobs offshore. This is just such, I think, a reversal of NAFTA, which gutted the United States. And it's so eerie. Ross Perot, another billionaire about two decades ago, you know, love him or hate him, he said, "Do you hear that giant sucking sound? That's what NAFTA is going to do to your jobs." And fast forward two decades, 15 years later, we've lost 5 to 6 million high-paying jobs and about 5 to 10,000 factories in the United States. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I'd like if you or somebody else didn't reconcile how we're supposedly at full employment, 4.6%. Some of this doesn't jive at all, and that's what many in our camp are complaining about, that the numbers aren't reflective of really what's going on. And it's the little people all over the country that, ironically enough, elected billionaire Trump because they're so unhappy with their own Democratic Party and the Republicans, and it's going to be an interesting time, that's for sure.
It is interesting, and I think you made a great point. The numbers, they're skewed. We've recently had, of course, I know you know John Williams well from Shadow Stats, and he's been such a big friend to the show, like yourself, and he's just made it clear, as have many others, by the way, that there's really closer to 100 million able-bodied, working-aged individuals, adults, in the United States who either can't find work, have given up looking for work, are disgruntled, or have simply tossed up their hands in disgust, or are underemployed. When you add all of it together, roughly one-third of the United States. But what I was alluding to is that I feel that this automation with the trucking and the Amazon and the rest, I mean, we're talking about millions of retail jobs are now at threat. And I know people thinking, oh, this is grandiose. It'll never happen. Folks, it's just like an ATM machine. People never thought that would catch on. And before you know it, there's one on every corner. Well, soon retail is going that way because they can't afford people. People are too expensive. We get sick, you know, all the normal things for normal people. Well, where I think this might be headed, and I wanted your 2 cents on it, what happens when, you know, unemployment gets to such a stage that they start talking about, as they're doing now, I think, between the lines, the elite, the powers that be, are talking about universal income, guaranteed income. And leading up to here is that with all this automation and artificial intelligence and robotics, as you pointed out, the little person, the everyday person, the omoyen, the person on the street, all of us really are facing, you know, this dislocation in employment. They're going to step in, we're reading, and offer this maybe $1,000 a month, maybe $2,000 a month, depending on your family's situation. That would seem to be the perfect recipe for runaway prices and hyperinflation. Any thoughts?
Well, it's a good point. And I think this has better be mentioned before what they did after the election. They were petrified of a Trump winning, and the markets did exactly the opposite. They've gone, the Dow's gone straight up ever since, all-time highs everywhere, gold gets killed, because they wanted to change perceptions. Price action makes market commentary, and they're scared to death of what could be really going on, so they want people thinking in a different way. And I think, yes, the one way out of present issues that you're discussing is to get inflation into the system. So they wanted to get gold and silver down first so the gold cartel could cover, which they've done. The open interest have collapsed. And now we're set up, I think, for, you know, the markets to take off. But, yeah, I think that's what's coming, and that's the way that's their only out is to inflate. And it's ironic. They're all talking about the reflation trade on CNBC and shows like that. What, are you kidding me? I mean, the gold and silver should be the big beneficiaries, but as we in the Gata camp have learned, you know, good news for gold is bad news. What you want is no news, and it happens every single time. However, I think we're bottoming out here. We're washing out, and we should take off very soon to the upside.
Yeah, I agree with you, and our mutual friend John Embry at Sprott Asset Management, of course, also agrees with you. He sees this as an incredible valuation. I think we're also approaching very enticing valuation levels for precious metals, you know, relative to paper assets. Debt instruments are wildly oversold, and I think equities are extremely overbought. It's just a few little indexes that appear to be holding up the entire edifice. Really common to have that end-of-the-year equities rally, and as the holidays approach and everyone's in a festive mood and retail sales are in, when that rolls over in the new year, the hangover emerges. I suspect that you will see a rush into gold and silver in 2017. It looks like it's shaping up. We almost always get an end of year rally in the precious metals right around the last week or so into the new year.
Chris, we often do. Of course, last year we closed right in the tank. So, but I couldn't agree more that 2017 is shaping up as something big, and for me to be correct, it's got to be much more volatile on the upside than we saw this year. And I think you're going to see a silver market trade like copper just did, and it's going to, once it breaks 21, it ought to just explode.
And of course, we have the CRB index behind that, solidly behind the underpinning the West Texas Intermediate crude, black gold, as well as copper. While the precious metals have been correcting, the CRB has remained relatively strong, even in face of the stronger greenback. So I think that you're right. I mean, it looks like the rocket pad, if you will, is being set for a really good 2017.
Yeah, for many of us, it's darkest before the dawn, and I think for a lot of investors, it's especially frustrating because of what the stock market's doing, and it's just human nature to watch what they're doing going straight up and to have our sector be under siege, and I think that will change dramatically, and we just got to get through this period. And again, I think the markets are washed out, and this is a time to be involved, because I'm prejudiced, but, you know, being bullish, but I know how artificially low these prices are because of what the gold cartel has done, and that has to be rectified, and 2017 ought to be the year that it happens.
Bill Murphy, please tell people more about La Metropole Cafe and Gata, if you'd like.
Well, I've said I've been doing it 19 years. People who are interested can sign up for a two-week free trial at lametropolecafe.com, and my colleague Chris Powell does a great job with his stuff, and they can sign up to get on his list at www.gata.org. And thanks for having me.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. The swamp is fighting back. The swamp does not want to be drained. The swamp in Washington is a kind of breakaway civilization that in many ways has grown so detached from the everyday challenges of the average person that the defenders of the swamp, the mainstream media, misjudged both the rise and effectiveness of the direct media, what some call the alternative or independent media. The mainstream media was spanked hard on election night. Some talking heads and commentators were on the verge of tears, and some were actually crying. Post-election coverage has been all over the board. Unspoken innuendo in the form of actions taken on the part of those who were spanked by voters because they didn't pay attention and didn't listen has resulted in recount efforts by Green Party candidate Jill Stein, and more disturbingly, a press conference by Secretary Clinton, where she is going for broke by perpetuating the fake news meme and implying fake news was somehow responsible for her loss, and the difficult or unwelcome questions are somehow a threat, especially when those answering the questions prefer to avoid transparency and responsibility. On the MSNBC Morning Joe program with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, Joe Scarborough commented following Secretary Clinton's fake news press conference by saying, "Listen, if you care about Democrats digging out of the hole that they have put themselves in now, you've got to ask yourself, what have Democrats done to so offend Americans that they only have 11 governorships, they've lost control of the Senate, they've lost control of the House, they lost 900 legislative seats over the past 6 years. He continued, "It wasn't fake news. It was something much, much bigger." He's correct. It was and is much bigger. As one small example, the analysis provided by my commentaries over the past 9.5 years on GoldSeek.com radio, and countless others in the direct media, have in large part dissected fake mainstream media news, misdirection, manipulation, and outright lies, in order to help listeners reframe contradictions they are trying to reconcile in their own understanding of how current events impact them, their businesses, and their families. But the implication of this continuing fake news rhetoric by prominent leaders and suggestions to now restrict or somehow regulate the direct media is a not-so-veiled threat against free speech and independent analysis of political job performance, an area of discussion that political leaders and mainstream media no longer have a monopoly on. In fact, mainstream media is rapidly becoming obsolete. Charles Darwin said, "It's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." Those who failed to adapt to changing technology, communication preferences, and the new ways to establish trust, which in this case was with voters, are now trying desperately to muddy the waters through fear and intimidation of those who would challenge or simply question the status quo. Individuals who in many cases have audiences and followings that rival those of mainstream media outlets. However, with direct media, it's not just the number of followers a person has. It's the cumulative impact of retweeting, reposting, texting, emailing, and word-of-mouth distribution, of messages and points of view that in many ways challenge what always seemed to work for those in charge. They're only just waking up to it now, because reality has overtaken their ability to manage and control mainstream perceptions, and thus reality itself. Dangerous precedents are attempting to be set with the repetitive, haranguing tone of mainstream media professing to now call everything under the sun fake news. Where have they been for the past decade or two? When calls for exposure of gold price manipulation have been made, they have remained silent and perpetuated a false narrative. Where have they been as calls for accurate representation of unemployment statistics have been made? They have remained silent. Where have they been as calls for accurate representation of the real cost of government bailouts resulting from the financial collapse of 2008 have been made? They have remained silent and again perpetuated a false narrative. Where have they been as calls for accurate representation of a national health care plan whose costs have already ballooned out of control and was sold to the public with misrepresentations, such as, you can keep your doctor? They have, for the most part, remained silent. There is so much noise and confusion being generated in a coordinated effort to sell the fake news meme and avoid responsibility for a hard election loss that many will assume where there's smoke, there must be fire. But is that actually true? Referring back to another discussion on Morning Joe, this time by Mika Brzezinski, where she responded to a post-election rant by Elizabeth Warren by saying, "Do you lead on anger, though? Because that doesn't seem very constructive to me. I gotta tell you, I love her. I'm getting tired of this act. You know what? There's a huge part of the country that doesn't think Donald Trump is a disaster. And she might want to be a little inclusive because she is sounding like the people she is accusing of being exclusive." She went on to say, "I mean, she's just got to stop. I'm sorry, it's getting exhausting. It's not going to work. At some point, we have to look at what happened and look at the people we've lost along the way." And many have been lost along the way. Confabulated poll numbers setting unrealistic expectations of election victory due to top-heavy sampling sizes were never parsed with a critical eye by very many in advance of the election. It's as if mainstream media invented its own post-election parallel universe that they were going to shoehorn the voting population into by managing public expectations instead of reporting on them. In an attempt to quash dissenting points of view and muddying the waters by trying to discredit in advance the subject matter and many unanswered questions that remain from disclosures like WikiLeaks and next chapters in various ongoing investigations. The shadowy actions that have followed the election to cast doubt and suspicion on the validity of the results, including recounts, blaming foreign powers, and now, rather than attempting to embrace direct media and utilize it more effectively the next time around, those who were displaced by it are crying foul and suggesting they want to censor what they cannot control, because it forces a kind of accountability mainstream media has never had to answer to, one that comes directly from the people themselves. The genie is out of the bottle, and it isn't going back in. Those who have just figured out that people, voters, are communicating behind the back of mainstream media, and in doing so are forming their own independent analysis, regardless of the official narrative, those who have just figured this out need to realize that they are behind the technology and learning curve. The world has already moved on, and it isn't going to wait for them. The threats of censorship, which are already underway by technology giants to change search engine algorithms, thereby rendering certain people and discussions invisible. Or the threat of hearings by certain lawmakers to stifle independent inquiry and chill free speech. These actions, among others yet to be proposed, will only strengthen the resolve of the people, who will not tolerate a regression to more censorship. Chris, I'd like to urge our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and sign up for my new email list. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.